The Documentary Photographer, Episode 9, Research, Depth and Understanding.
Welcome to The Documentary Photographer, the podcast about how to put life in the frame. Here's your host, Roger Overall.
Hello and welcome to Episode 9 of the Documentary Photographer podcast. My name's Roger Overall and I'm a documentary photographer based in Cork in Ireland. In this episode, I'm joined in conversation by David Creedon. I first came across David's work at the National Portrait Gallery in London, where I visited the exhibition of the 2011 Taylor Wessing Prize. I was quite surprised to see a number of documentary images in the competition, because Taylor Wessing is actually a portrait prize. But then it occurred to me that documentary photographs reveal as much, if not more, about people as portrait photographs do. One of the documentary photographs that really caught my attention was by David, and it's a picture called Maria and Raoul. Now let me describe it to you. It's a photograph taken inside a bedroom in Cuba, and it shows an elderly couple. It shows Maria sleeping on the bed, and Raoul in his chair. He's not asleep, his eyes are open, but I've subsequently learned that he's blind. And it's a very tender moment, and the people in the photograph are quite vulnerable. And while I was looking at it, I just started to wonder how the photographer had managed to get access to such an intimate moment. Many months later, here in Cork, I was talking to a friend of mine before she flew out to Cuba, a lady by the name of Tanya Buwalda, who is also responsible for the Cuban food blog at cubanfoodblog.com. And she mentioned David to me, and we got talking, and then it turned out that not only did she know of this photographer who'd taken this wonderful photograph that I'd sort of carried with me ever since and just thought it was absolutely wonderful, but that he actually lived in Cork. He lives 20 minutes away from me. So I couldn't resist. I had to take the opportunity to connect with David and do an interview with him. Now, in the interview, you'll hear how David connects with the stories that he photographs. He goes into great detail about background, he quotes statistics, he has a very good knowledge of his subject. Sometimes he does the research subsequent to actually taking the photographs, and you'll hear a little bit about that in the interview. You'll also hear in the interview how he's taught himself new skills to help him sell the documentary photographs that he takes. And finally, as a bit of a revelation for me during the conversation, he has a particular way of taking his photographs. Please join me in conversation with David Creedon. David Creedon, thank you very much for taking time to talk today.
Thank you, Roger, and thank you for the invitation.
Oh, gosh, I think I already said in my introduction what a coincidence it was that I first came across your work in London, and then a friend tells me that you live down the road from me and here in Cork.
Yes. I've always lived in Cork, which is a very nice city, and London isn't too, any of the major cities in fact aren't too far away.
Yes.
I mean, London's only an hour. When I used to go to London, photographers in London saying, "What are you doing here again? Do you live here?" And I'd say, "No, but it's easier and faster for me to get to London than just to get to Dublin."
Mm.
So, and it seemed to be the logical place to go with my work anyway, then Ireland, where there's not really a big industry of the style of work that I do.
Let's actually talk about the kind of work that you do. How would you describe yourself as a photographer?
I don't know. And that's not being flippant or anything like that. I used to think possibly, maybe I had a vision of myself as being a photojournalist, but really I'm not a photojournalist. I certainly deal with history, and I deal with documentary, and I suppose I kind of fall into that genre. I also fall into the genre of art for some reason, and that's, I don't know how my work kept getting into galleries, but it subsequently does. It keeps getting exhibited and published.
Was that never an intention of yours? Is that something that's sort of happened by coincidence?
But it happened by coincidence. But was it an intention? Of course it was an intention, because I think all artists, no matter what you are, whether you're a musician or any artist, you always want to see your stuff on public display. And I'm no different than that. Not everybody can be the next Beatles or anything like that, but it was an accident in the way it happened. It wasn't pre-planned. I had been working on a project which didn't have a title, but subsequently became Ghosts of the Faithful Departed, and I was asked by some photographers would I give them a lecture, and I kind of had resisted for a long time because I felt I didn't have anything really that I wanted to show them, but I eventually relented, and I got 12 of the images printed up, and I brought them down to my framer to be mounted so I could present them, and when I called to collect them there was only 10 ready. Forgot all about the other two. Subsequently, I was in London, and I got a call a couple of weeks later, and I got a call from my framer to say, "David, where are you? There's a woman in my shop. She wants to see the rest of this portfolio." And I said, "Look, I'm sorry, I'm in London, but look, tell her I'll meet her tomorrow, and I'll show her them then." And she says she won't be here. And I says, look, just get her email address and we'll email her out. And a couple of, I think about a week or two later, I eventually went down to pick up the two prints, and my framer says to me, "Where have you been? You're not answering your phone. And this woman has been on the phone every day wanting to see these images." So I says, "Look, give me the email address." And I emailed her off, I don't know, 10 or 15 images. Thought no more about it. Subsequently my framer followed up on it and rang her and asked her, "Did David send you those images?" And she says, "I don't know." She says, "Hold on, I'll check my email." And all my framer heard, and she told me this, was, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." And the following Saturday night I got a phone call at home from this woman, Sarah McCarthy. And she says, "I love your work. I know nothing about the art world, but I love your artwork, and I have great contacts." She says, "Will you exhibit this work for me?" And I said, I'd love to. Being the desire of all artists, I'd like to be asked things like that. And I said, I'll exhibit them. Where will we do it? We'll do it here, she said. And I says, "Where's here?" "Chicago." And I was kind of taken back. But then I knew she was serious, because she had just gone back to Chicago. And I think within 2 weeks, she was back in Ireland to come over. And I showcased them for her in my framer shop. And I think we opened the following September in Chicago. And I think there's not a month gone by since I haven't been exhibited somewhere.
Wow. And the Faithful Departed work, can you give a description of what that is? I mean, I've seen it, but just for the viewers who might not yet be aware of what that is.
It's a body of work of interiors of abandoned houses in Ireland. And really, the houses were left abandoned, still with items of everything inside, clothes, what have you left there. But the interesting thing about that was, there was two things that were interesting: the colour of the houses, the colour of the paints on the wall. There was greens, reds, blues, very, very vibrant colours, totally different than what my mother would paint her house. I mean, she used to only pick magnolia for any time she wanted to paint the house, it was magnolia, but these were very, very vibrant. And something strange happened, because I was shooting up to then on a Linhof 6.9 black and white, and I bought a Canon digital camera, and I said, "Look, I'll just try this," and I couldn't believe the way the colours came out. They were quite accurate, and I was very lucky. I found a new printer who reproduced it the way that I saw it. And but the story really behind it, I started examining why these houses were abandoned, and I heard a politician on the radio one day, it was Emmett Stagg, I think, who said that the Irish government should consider giving pensions to people who emigrated in the 1950s, because by emigrating they took the burden off the state. And now that these people were 65, 70, some of them living in horrendous conditions, and there's not too many of them there, maybe the government should give them the pension, because Ireland was going through the Celtic Tiger, money, the country was awash with money. And that piqued my interest, and I related that then with the houses, and I started examining the story behind it, and I discovered that between 1949 and 1989, over 800,000 people left the country. And by 1956, the population had fallen to 2.8 million, which was the lowest that was ever recorded. And in fact, if you were to go back 100 years prior to that, Ireland's population was close to 9 million. So this was the biggest drop of population in Western Europe. And I also discovered things like, you know, because of the so much emigration, there was parts of the country, counties like Leitrim and Cavan, really were devastated. And it had the highest instances of depression and schizophrenia in Western Europe. And what you normally found in a small rural farm, maybe five or six people, and everybody knew growing up that they'd be emigrating. So you might have some go to England or some go to America. And others then, there would always be one that would stay behind to help on the family farm. But he'd end up looking after the parents as well. And because it's the system has changed now in the farming community, the guy who stayed behind wasn't the guy, may not be the guy who was going to inherit the farm. It could go to another son who's in England or America. And so these young boys used to never marry, because A, they didn't have the money to do so, and B, they didn't want to bring another woman under the same roof as their mother. So by the time the parents died off, you could have these who were once young men were now in their 50s and really not the marrying type. Really, they were bachelors, and there was a huge population in Ireland of bachelor farmers. When they died, by the time we got up to the 80s and 90s, they were now this bachelor population was starting to die off, and title of the property may have gone to some other relative in the UK or America, who, by the way, at this stage could already be dead. So, and you know, even though if they weren't dead, they might have, you know, dreams to come back and do up the house, but some of them never did. And all these houses were still there with all their contents, and I spent, 2 years photographing all this and putting it together and doing the research. But I found when I went to exhibit it, a few things happened, actually. First of all, when it went to London and it went also to Tbilisi, it went all over Europe, but it had a resonance in Eastern Europe especially, because what was happening, happened in Ireland in the 1950s was now happening in Eastern Europe. So it went down very, very well there. The other thing that happened, especially in Ireland, was anybody who was born after 1980 seemed to have the impression that there were studio setups, where people born before that understood straight away. But I think if you were born after 1980, you just didn't understand Ireland of a previous age, heavily dominated by the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church had more power than the government. A few examples of that would be that in 1947, Archbishop John McQuaid banned the use of Tampax for women. And he referred to it as internal tamponade, because he had seen young girls playing hockey, and he felt that their use of this sanitary towel would cause some sort of stimulation. And he had got it on good authority that from a medical source that this caused infertility and by default contraception. So Tampax was banned, and at the same time, about 1947, there was a new coalition government who was led by John Cosgrove, what was it, Cosgrove, I think, but he appointed a new Minister for Health, which was Noel Brown, who wanted to bring in a mother and child scheme. And what that was going to do was provide mothers and their children with health care, children up to the age of 16. And the Catholic Church went against it. And one of the reasons they went against it, because part of the bill that was going to come in was that mothers would be educated on sex. And the church did not want that. And there was a real standoff between, not the government, but a standoff between the Minister for Health and the Catholic Church. And in one instance, and this is on the Parliament record, that you had the Prime Minister saying to the House that he had sought permission from the Archbishop and received it to speak to his own Minister for Health, which is absolutely outrageous. And there's minutes of the Cabinet meetings where it says they would never go against the Church in case they get a belt of the crozier. But that was Ireland back then, you know.
How did you find that reflected in the houses, in the abandoned houses that you came across then?
Well, I think very religious people. You could see that. I knew from my own my mother, who was very, very religious as well. You'd have, you know, pictures or statues in every room. And this was equally reflected in these. I think some of the interesting things for me, it wasn't so much taking the photographs, because I'm a very patient photographer. I'm quite happy to come home at the end of the day with one photograph and really be happy that I've done something, rather than take 50 or 60 of nothing. But if I get one that's right and I feel something about it. But the interesting thing about that project was sitting down in these empty houses, just reading letters. And you're waiting for the light. You might wait for the light to come around and say, well, the light won't be around for another hour, you know. And so you sit down, have a cigarette, and you find a letter or something, and you just wait. And you get these stories coming back from New York, and sometimes at the top of the letter would be a safety pin, and that safety pin was to hold money. And it was said that by 1961 that the Irish sent back something in the region, the Irish abroad sent something back, something in the region of £13 million to people at home. And that was the same year that the Department of Education, that was their budget for the year. And somebody quipped, wasn't it strange how people who left school at 14 were now funding the education system in Ireland?
It's, well, I think the diaspora is something that's very current as well in Ireland.
It is.
Of course.
Well, I think we were always really an emigrant society, except for the couple of years when we had the Celtic Tiger, when the trend was reversed. Mm. And I think nobody ever wants to leave their home. They'd rather stay and work at home, or at home. And I think people who left in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, their dreams and aspirations was sometime to come home. And I think one example of that I found in Ghosts was a photograph I took, which I titled The Return. It was of an old shipping trunk, and on the shipping trunk were two labels, and the first label said United States Lines to All America, and the second label said Mary O'Sullivan, 16th of August 1949, New York to Cove, cabin class. And the ship she came home on, the USS America, had three classes: cabin class, tourist class, and first class. And Mary coming home cabin class, on the menu was wild Irish smoked salmon and caviar. And when you opened her case, you found ladies' nylon stockings still in their original packaging with Nylons by DuPont written on it. You found her bank book from the Hibernian Bank in Brooklyn or someplace, and she had saved $8,500, a fortune in 1949. But really, Mary had come home to die. And also inside in her case were letters from home. And I had to do the research and find out when she went out. And she went out in 1930, in October 1930, on the White Star Liner, the Cedric, out of Queenstown, which is Cove. And when she arrived at Ellis Island, she had $15. So she obviously done well and then came home. But the whole family emigrated around there. Her sister had gone out in 1910. And she was working in New York. And I presume she would have sponsored Mary's ticket to go out, which would have been the case in a lot.
I'm just curious then, because you're in this environment, you're in these rooms, these houses that are abandoned. In how many cases was there still a claim on the property? Did you have to seek permission to go in, or was that simply not an issue in many cases?
I'm not sure whether it was an issue or not, but all those houses that I photographed were open to the public. Mm-hmm. I came across a lot of houses that were closed that you couldn't get access, and that was fine. But if the door was open, I felt that's okay. Mm-hmm. I can go in and do it. In regard to licensing or consent forms and stuff like that, somebody somewhere owns that, those houses, because of title and inheritance. But who they are, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And but somebody owns it. They could be anywhere.
Mm. Just changing tack then, because you're. A lot of your work is interiors and is architecture related, almost to the exclusion of humans, although there are clues and signs of human either activity or presence. Mm. Yet a lot of your work in Cuba has been portraiture and people in their environment. I'm curious about gaining access there, because there you seem to have had an extraordinary amount of access where you allowed into people's homes.
Well, my relationship with Cuba goes back to 2009. Actually, it probably goes back slightly. In 2008, I started photographing. I heard the story about how Steinway Piano Company of New York had got the biggest order of their 150-year history. One client had bought 57 grand pianos. And I thought, what an incredible story. And I discovered that the client was in Cork. And I said, that's a fantastic one. So I formulated this idea that I'd like to photograph every piano and have maybe put together a portfolio with a different piano in every photograph. And I went and did the tests on it, and they said there's great colour in the rooms. They said, and I said, that's fantastic.
I have to ask, because the listeners are going, who's this client? Now I have a very good idea who it might be.
Yes, I think of the client was the Irish government. Okay. You see, when the Irish had money, we were very decadent, and cost was not an object on anything. We wanted to be we were the second richest people in the world at one stage. But the Irish government had bought 57 Steinway grand pianos for the Cork School of Music. And so my idea was to shoot them all. And the first, when I did the test, that was fantastic. The test was brilliant, because the rooms were colourful. But when I went back and started doing, when I had done all the agreements with them and everything, I discovered they weren't colourful. They were actually just white walls in most rooms. And I went, oh God, how am I going to do this? And it kind of turned into a chore. But I had just started, and I made the agreement with them, when about 3 o'clock in the morning, I heard this fantastic story about Irish piano tuners who go to Havana to fix the pianos because there's no tuners in Cuba. And I says, this can't be right. So I tracked them down, phoned them up, and they said, yeah, this is what we do. We're a charity. And they told me that they get holiday makers to bring parts out to Havana in their luggage, and everybody brings out about maybe a kilo or something like that. And I said, this is a great story. And I said, look, this is better than the Steinway story. I'd like to do this. And I applied to the Cuban embassy for a work visa to go and do this story, and I heard nothing back. And about 6 or 7 months went by, and there was nothing happening. So I said, that's gone, you know, that's not going to happen. So I decided to go to Southeast Asia. And I was about on a Friday to book Southeast Asia, and I got a phone call from the embassy, the Cuban embassy, who said, your visa's approved. And I couldn't believe it, but you'll have to come to Dublin for an interview. So I arrived in the embassy at on the following Tuesday, and I think by the Thursday I was in Havana. Wow. And I went, I came back, and I did the work, and I sold it to the BBC and a few other places. But I was delighted. But the embassy were delighted with the work I did. They thought it was fantastic. And I knew when I was leaving Cuba, Cuba was the nicest place I ever visited. The people were fantastic. And I knew leaving I'd be going back. You know, there's countries I've visited, I said, I never want to see that again, I've done that. But Cuba was absolutely brilliant. And I decided I would go back in 2011. And I had heard the story about the Hershey train, which runs between Matanzas and Casablanca. Now, it's only about a 40-kilometer train ride, but it could take about 12 hours to do. You know, the train might break down, they might stop or have a chat with their neighbours. And the train was the oldest electrical train in the world. It was built in 1919. So I thought, yeah, this sounds like a plan. It's an excuse that I need to go back to Cuba. But when I arrived, temperatures were now up to 40 degrees. And this was really too hot for me, because I had a slight experience the previous time I was there where I passed out from dehydration and that. And I just didn't want to get sunstruck, and I didn't want to photograph people on the street. I knew, look, every photographer who goes to Cuba does cars, architecture, crumbling, the women with the big cigars, the schoolgirls in the brown uniforms, and street photography. And I just didn't want to do that. I felt this was not me. But I found an artist's agent, and I hired a fixer. And the brief was very, very simple. Just bring me to how Cubans live. That's all I wanted to know. And that's how it started. And we ended up just knocking on. We broke up Havana into different districts. And we do maybe a district, not a day, but you know, you might do one or two, three pictures, because I'm still a very slow photographer. I mean, Orlando, you say to me, you are the slowest photographer I've ever worked with. And I says, I know, but we're trying to get it right. I don't want to come home and find it wrong. And I spent 6 weeks in Cuba photographing that, just going from district to district and maybe out into the countryside.
And how were you received when you're knocking on doors and you're saying, I'd like to come in and take a photograph?
Well, I think if I did it in Europe, I think they'd be phoning the police. I couldn't do it. I don't see myself doing it in Ireland, because I think there was mistrust. But you know, Orlando was very good at persuading him of what we were trying to do. And I think I would never photograph anybody who didn't want to be photographed anywhere. And I would never use any image that somebody was unhappy with.
Just on that then, David, were you showing people photographs off the back of the camera, or did you do prints?
No, well, the 6 weeks I spent in Cuba were broken up into 2-3 week trips. When I came back after the first 3 weeks, I thought, okay, Somebody must have done these. Let's do a bit of research and try and find a whole section of a portfolio on interiors in Cuba. And I couldn't find anybody, and I couldn't believe it. And then I had sent one to the National Portrait Gallery for the Taylor Wessing, and it got accepted. And I said, well, I have enough for an exhibition, but not enough for a book. I better go back. And when I went back the second time, I got a dummy book made up. And by showing it to people, they'd say, oh, I know that person. Yeah, come on into my house and we'll do it. And they were very hospitable, very generous people with their time. And also, you know, they'd offer you coffee. And, you know, I was getting concerned because I realized things like coffee are a premium out there. But they were offering me things. And it wasn't just about going in, doing a quick shoot and gone. I was quite happy to stay there an hour, 2 hours, and just talk. And we got, and I think that's why it kind of worked well. I remember going to a woman's house, and she was 104. And when I arrived, she was cooking the dinner. She was chopping vegetables. And when she heard, you know, she was delighted to, she wanted her photograph taken. And she went off and got ready. And when she came back, we did the photograph. But I used a kind of a walking cane with her, a walker. Asked her to hold on to a walker. It's not that she needed it. It was actually for me. So for the second exposure, that she would be steady for that. And when we had finished, she went back and changed back into her work clothes and then went off finishing the dinner. And she says, will you stay for dinner? Because I'm on television later on. So I says, television later on? Love to stay. And we stayed and we had dinner and we watched her on television where she was recounting her life in growing up in Cuba. And just a marvellous experience, marvellous people, and a great, great country. I think a thing what happened when I came back, something happened that I didn't expect, was that individually all the photographs to me looked fine when I was taking them and everything. But when you printed them off and laid them out as a kind of a portfolio on the floor, you just got a different, it just told a different story. And it wasn't a story, it was just kind of a story of people who were poor, and it wasn't a particularly story I really wanted to go with, because I think people who did know nothing about Cuba would get the wrong impression of the country, and I didn't really want to do that, and I felt that would have been disrespecting them. So I went and I studied for about 6 to 8 months American foreign policy. And when I understood that and understand what went on in Guatemala in the 50s, I could then understand Cuba. And then I just finally released them there in, I think they came out on the 1st of April in the UK, and they're now exhibiting in Portugal at the moment.
And how did that, the 8 months, how did that help you, if you like, shift your understanding or your perception of the photographs? Because I suppose when you're a documentary photographer, you want to tell the truth, you want to get a genuine story across, but you don't want, I mean, you don't want to be telling something that you don't feel is right. How had learning about American foreign policy kind of changed your connection with those photographs?
Because what I discovered, I mean, my perception of Cuba probably before I went, and it's a perception that's out there by quite a lot of people, that it's an awful country, in the sense that it's a dictatorship. People are poor. And really, a lot of it is American rhetoric. But studying American foreign policy meant, you know, going into Eisenhower's private libraries and having a look. But I discovered, before the revolution, 80% of the population were suffering from malnutrition, while the country was being run by the mafia and B, the United Fruit Company. Now, the United Fruit Company are an interesting company. And you really have to go back to Guatemala to see what happened in Guatemala in the 50s, where the second most powerful man in Guatemala was the US ambassador. And there was free elections came into Guatemala in the early 50s. And a new president came in who said, look, we're going to go to a democratic society. And he did his 4 years or 3 years, and a new president was elected who said he was going to continue these reforms of going towards democracy. And he wanted to bring agrarian reforms in where unused land was given to the people because they were equally starving. But most of the land in Guatemala was owned by a company called the United Fruit Company, who are an American company. And on their board were seven members of Eisenhower's administration, including the two Dulles brothers, who were deputy director of the CIA, and I think the other brother was, I think he was foreign affairs or not, or whatever, secretary of state, that's what he was. And they said, shag that for a game of darts, who do they think they are? And they misrepresented nationalism for communism. And of course this was time of the McCarthy era and the House of Un-American Activities and all that, and they decided they were going to do a coup on them. We don't want our land taken, and you know, and United Fruit Company never paid a penny in tax in Guatemala, and President Arbenz was saying, no, you're going to have to pay tax now. And so they overthrew him. But the same was going on in Cuba. And 80% of the population of Cuba were suffering from malnutrition. And when Castro came in, it was a very populist revolution. And one of the things Castro did was go to Eisenhower for help. And he went to New York, and Eisenhower told him, I'm too busy to meet you. I've got a golf game. And so Castro said, right, and went to Khrushchev and said. But again, the Americans misunderstood nationalism for communism, but they wanted to portray that way. And then the follow-up to that, of course, was the disaster of Bay of Pigs, which Kennedy inherited from Eisenhower. And then the missile crisis, which probably suited... The missile crisis may not have happened had America had not been carrying out all these war games around Cuba at the time, you know, pretending to invade a fictitious Central American country. And it is only, you know, when you had the blockade and the constant economic blockade that country has suffered, can you see how they can't afford things. And even though they had support from the USSR, when they collapsed in 1990, the country was on the verge of famine. And America's response for that was to bring in legislation that would stop any ship landing in Cuba would not be allowed into an American port. And they really wanted to put the stranglehold. But Cuba came through it in their own way, and they went over to a kind of a green economy, even though they had no oil. They're now getting oil from Venezuela. But they're a country without any foreign investment. And what they have done is quite remarkable. People would not have a disposable income, let's say, in the thing. But you've ended up with a country who have concentrated on investing in their people in education and in health. And they're probably way better than what's happening in any Western country. You know, what they've done is absolutely remarkable with the resources that they have.
And then, so you have that backstory that then shines through, because suddenly you can connect what you're seeing in your photographs to the history. So if there is poverty, there is a reason for it. And in a lot of the photographs that I've seen of yours, is this dignity, and there's a real strength in a lot of the people as well. I am curious though, when you go in and you tell the story of the lady who was 104, and she went off to change for you.
She went away and changed,
As a documentary photographer, I mean, what is your urge to say, no, you're fine as you are? Or because you're having an impact on the situation. You're having an impact on their lives at that moment. So that has an impact on the photographer.
Normally, I would say no. But how can you turn down a 104-year-old woman? I mean, yeah, if the woman wants to do it, that is absolutely fine. And I was delighted she did, because she was absolutely fantastic. You couldn't say no. She wanted to present herself in the best possible way. And I was quite happy for her to do it. But in most cases, in one or two, you know, they'd want to kind of tidy up. And I'm going, no, leave it as it is. This is how we're shooting. And they'd say, fine. Mm. But that was the only person, actually, that the 104. I never even thought of it. I just...
That's a very good point. How do you turn down a 104-year-old lady, a television personality to boot? What do you look for in a photograph, David? What is a good documentary image for you, for David Creedon?
My images are very simple. There's absolutely no secret. No matter what I'm photographing, whether it's out of ghosts or out of the pianos or any other portfolio, there are simple compositions in most cases. I hate looking at photographs where I see nothing and the eye is wandering around. I just would like my photographs, I'd like to have them, one thing in them that the eye can settle on, and then everything else is built around that. And then lighting is very important to me as well.
Yeah, because you're a big proponent of, I'd say, natural light. I wouldn't even say available light, ambient light. The light that's in the situation.
Yes, yeah. I much prefer that. I hate dealing with strobes or flashes or anything like that. I think it kills atmosphere. I know you're using longer exposures. I mean, I can use exposures up to 14, 15 minutes at times. In the portraits in Cuba, you were talking half a second to 6 seconds. I think one of them was 6 seconds, which surprised me. On average, I think in Cuba it was about half a second, which is still quite long. And you don't see it till you blow them up, you know. And I'm thinking maybe I should have used a popping flash there, but that goes way then from what my thinking is and all.
So you must be using a tripod then.
Oh, I never take a photograph without a tripod. Oh. No matter what it is, I won't use. I will always use a tripod. It's just a habit from the Linhof, when 'twas so heavy you just had to use the tripod, and I just continued on the same ethos as I had with that old system.
And I'm curious then, because some of the photographs then where you've got the subject looking to camera. You can understand how that works with a tripod because you know, there's an element of direction, there's an element of, well, be yourself, but I want to photograph you in this context, and we're very aware of each other. But then other photographs you take, it's almost that the people are unaware of you, but now you're telling me you're in their room with a camera and a tripod.
Yeah, they were all quite well aware that I was there, But I think in the kind of group shots of them, you know, I remember the woman on the bed, she had one leg and her neighbour had called in to do her hair. And she's sitting on her bed. But then the two kids came in and wanted to watch television. So they were kind of more interested in the television than they were, what's that? And that was the strange thing about Cuba. You could be in someone's house, in their front room, and other household members would walk in and they wouldn't bat an eyelid, like, what's going on out there? And then if you we did some in apartment buildings where we were doing them maybe by the elevator shaft or whatever, and next thing you'd have a big crowd around you looking on, curious, just like the circus coming to town. All natural light. I do use reflectors. And that's all I use if I need it, you know. And I like this kind of chiaroscuro kind of lighting where the light is hitting the subject and the background is slightly down a bit.
It's the Dutch Masters technique.
Yeah, and I didn't know it was the Dutch Masters till somebody wrote about it and said, the Irish Independent call me Cork's Vermeer.
That's not a bad compliment to have. No. David, just a couple more questions. You seem to spend a lot of time researching your topics. How much time is involved researching, and how much time do you actually spend taking photographs?
It's the old 80-20 rule. 20% inspiration and 80% perspiration. Sometimes you go and work. You sometimes, like Ghosts was an accident. I think the Last Cooper, which is about my father, I'm still kind of researching. But having said that, I know Ghosts of the Faithful Departed is out now in a book. But there's really still kind of research going on about it, because you hear these stories and you'd say, God, it's a pity I didn't know that. I'm going to incorporate that now into the talk, artist talk or something like that. You know, so there's research all the time. But maybe I want the people who see them to feel what I feel about them, you know, because I do very little commercial work. I don't want to do commercial work. I only want to photograph my own stories, and I'm hoping that people who look at my work will be as interested in the stories as I am, you know, and find them as interesting as I do.
That actually begs the question, because a lot of people listening to this will be documentary photographers to whom your approach is going to be very, very appealing. But they're going to be wondering, well, how, if you don't take commercial work, how do you make a living out of this? How, what are your outlets for your work? Who pays the piper?
Well, I'm kind of a bit more luckier than some. I was with a few photographers the other day, and they all says, well, you know, we just can't make a living. We have to work. And I think Simon Norfolk once said, you know, you have to have something else going on in the background to support this. I think if I had to be a commercial photographer, I would cry. It would be like going to a production line in the morning for some reason. I get asked all the time to do weddings. Oh my God, I nearly cry when I'm asked. And they're cruel, you know. For me, they're cruel anyway. And I can't do that kind of stuff. I just want to work the way I work. It's extremely difficult for even if you are a wedding photographer or anything, it's extremely difficult. But I'm kind of lucky. I have some resources other than photography to keep me going, and probably could keep me going for another 6-7 years, hopefully. And
then the work itself, where. How do you find markets for that? Because it is being used. It is being used.
Yeah. Let's say the piano, you know, outside the art magazines and the photographic magazines, there's music magazines. There's piano magazines, and you can hit all these. And sometimes I think, and I'm a very shy photographer. I really am shy at approaching somebody and stuff. I could not do approach somebody on a one-to-one. But I can certainly write an email and send it to editors and get as many editors to see my work as possible. And I think that's what photographers have to do. You just have to get it to see. And this is where the 80-20 rule kicks in. This is where you've got to get it out there. There's no point in having it and not knowing what to do with it. You've got to show it to somebody. I used to be nervous before. I suppose you're kind of nervous of rejection, you know. Like all artists, you're afraid that, you know, somebody won't like what I do or anything. But you have to honour yourself, and you have to honour your work, and you have to get it out there. Otherwise, there's no point. There's no point in putting them under a bed or in a thing, filing them away.
Do you, when you contact magazines, do you write as well, or are you simply supplying the photographs?
I'll do both. And really that was kind of an accident. That was never my intention, because I was just like happy just to supply the photographs. They've got a thing. But the BBC phoned me and said, we'd love to use these photographs. And I said, oh, that's great. That's fantastic, you know. And we'll have to use a whole lot of them. Will you write the article? And I kind of stepped back and said, will I write the article? And he said, and we'll pay you for that too. I says, okay. And I knew nothing about writing, because I hadn't written an essay since I was at school, which was a long, long, long time ago. And a week later, I came across this diploma in journalism. I says, oh yeah, I could do that. So I haven't done that for a year, and it did help an awful lot in how to write, not so much in a journalistic way, but how to get, you know, write to make editors or whatever interested in your story, to hook them in and keep them hooked, and which I knew nothing about. And that was a great, great help.
Fantastic. David, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I could sit here and talk all day with you. Just very briefly, what have you got going on at the moment, and where can people find out more about you listening to the podcast?
At the moment, I'm exhibiting in Braga in Portugal at their festival, and will be there till October. Not sure what's happening after that. I've kind of eased off a bit on exhibitions now, because certainly the costs involved of putting exhibitions together is quite expensive, and I think galleries are also feeling the pinch and not really wanting to spend money on transporting. I mean, Ghosts was half a ton in weight, so it was a big, it was a big show, and you know, you're talking about a lorry or a van, and that's all costly. So I'm at the moment now kind of restocking and trying to see what other ways I can go without having all these weight. The Portuguese exhibition was all handled by the festival out there, so there was no worries about expense involved, and that's probably where I'll probably go in future, I think. Mm-hmm. much better.
And where can we see your work if we can't get to
it? If you can't get to it, there's the website www.davidcreedon.com.
Brilliant. David, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Roger.
As always, I hope you found the interview interesting and that there was something in there for you to help you improve your documentary photography. If you'd like to read the show notes, you can go to thedocumentaryphotographer.net, where you'll find a blog and show notes for all the episodes of the Documentary Photographer podcast. If you'd like to leave some feedback by way of a comment or send me an email at roger@rogeroverall.net, please do. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Documentary Photographer podcast, and please join me again in episode 10.